Hey everyone, welcome to a special bonus episode of Rogue Signal, the typically bi-weekly games podcast for Rogue.site. I'm Ryan Gilliam, one of the co-founders and your usual host. With me are my other co-founders, Cass Marshall.
Hello.
And Jeffrey Perkin.
Hello.
The bi-weekly normal show is on hiatus until like the middle of January as our editor's busy and it's holiday season and it's game of the year time. But we are here, going to be here for this week and next week, being December 24th and January 2nd, to do our little game of the year debriefs here. So this is part one of our game of the year extravaganza for the Rogies. We're going to get into our rules, kind of how that works, but generally speaking, we're going to go over five of our big main tier categories here and talk about the winners, talk about the nominees, talk about our process going through it, give a little bit of background on just like what our goals were with these and just why the winners done won. And then next week, if you're listening to this right when it comes out, on January 2nd, we'll have part two, where we'll go over the rest of our more serious awards, as well as, most importantly, our top 10 game of the year. So you can check both of these out and get some additional context there. There's also a host of other sillier, less serious awards on the site, including like our individual lists. So you can hear from Jeff and Cass and I on what our favorite games of the year were. You can see what Alice's favorite game of the year was, since Alice doesn't show on this show on the regular. You can see what she's been up to. We got stuff like best character, best new character, and other games like stuff like that in the less serious awards. And then if you're listening to this before it's been concluded, you can click on some of these main stage awards as they come out, and you can vote on what you want the community version of the award to do. So we're going to do, we have a main R staff award, and then we'll also give out a community one as well. So please feel free to vote on those. We're going to get right into it with our first one, first best cozy game. But Jeff, do you want to talk a little bit about just the format in general here of what we decided to do with the Rogies this year, our first kind of stab at game of the year at our own self-important award show?
Yeah. You did a fantastic job describing it, better than any of us have so far, I think, because we wanted to make something that was both our own and kind of fun. And of course, we overcomplicated it. And there's what, a total of 20 categories for a four-person site, which is, you know, a bit ambitious.
Manageable.
So yeah,
and wise.
We came up with our 10 main categories, our serious categories, including Game of the Year. We all got together and we made lists of what we thought should be in each. We did some kind of informal voting and had ourselves a long discussion and picked our winners. Like, there were four of us, so there wasn't an extensive voting process or anything, but we think we picked really good games to be nominated, and we picked really good winners, I think.
I agree.
For the rest of them, our silly games, or our silly awards, rather, the Rogiolis, those were, we did a very similar process and picked winners, but those ones were not put into the audience poll just to kind of keep from overwhelming anybody. But we kept those a little more informal and just very, very much us here at Rogue.
It's definitely fun that we have four players who definitely don't have a ton of overlap. Expedition 33, of course, was, I'm sure some will say, ruinously underrepresented, simply because I think three of us didn't play it.
I'm the one that played it, and I like it a lot, but it's not my, like, number one game of the year. It's on my list, but it's not, like, high up on it, so.
Yeah, but we got a pretty good spread of things, you know, in the horror genre. I didn't play Static Dread, but Jeff loved it, so it got its time in the sun. And I definitely feel like, you know, my winter break, I'm going to have to catch up on some of these these games, because God knows it was a good year for them.
It was.
Funny note, by the way, and kind of by way of excuse and explanation, Claire Obscure came out exactly 1 week before we were all fired.
Yes. I think I wrote like anything for it.
Yep. So that's probably why we didn't play much.
Yeah, and that could also be why I was in like a very weird place probably when I was finishing it. So, maybe it would have hit a lot harder for me. Maybe it'll hit, it's going to do well in our inevitable, like, we should have probably played this one before the 2025 Game of the Year Awards category next year.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think it's worth just diving in a little bit about, like, the four-person aspect of it, because, like, I think one of the biggest strengths, like Cass said, is that we have a lot of, like, diversity in our interests, but also, again, like, don't get mad at us if Kingdom Come Deliverance didn't do super well on our list, because, like, Cass is the only person that played it. I'm the only person that played Expedition 33. I don't know if this is of interest of people, but, like, I served on the decision board for Polygon for the past couple of years when we did the Game of the Year thing. And the way that would typically work is we would do like a preliminary vote where everyone would come in and vote on what they wanted to do. And then the committee would meet and put in any things that we felt like were outliers or kind of like organize the list in a way that, I guess like kind of putting our thumb on the scale to a degree, which like, is both good and bad. I think there's merits there. I think having a purely vote-based thing, but like that's basically what our conversations were when the four of us got together was like, okay, I know that this game got the most votes, but does that mean it's actually the thing we think is the best game of the year? And usually the answer to that's no. So it's good to have like a small panel like we did at Polygon, but at Polygon, like the stuff, the popular stuff would always rise to the top because it would be the thing the most people played. But when you only have four people, you get a lot more like wild diverse things and us coming together to agree on stuff. Like I don't think I've seen anything else award our game of the year. And I don't think it would win at a bigger site, which I think is great. Super fun. And so like that's the part of the big goal of us here and what we want to do is make sure that we are giving like recommendations and making sure that like people are seeing games that they haven't heard of or that we're highlighting stuff that even if it's a big game, it's a game that maybe you haven't thought about in a minute. And that's like delightful to me that I think the four of us have come together to try to find stuff that we all agree on. We have pretty different taste a lot of times. Sorry, Jeff, I stepped over you like three times.
No. I mean, I think that's really good thing to highlight is our Game of the Year awards, our Rogies, are not a fair and balanced national election. They're an editorial decision that we're making. Like,
yes,
we voted. Yes, we think that we were as fair as four people could be to represent such a big industry, but we chose the winners we chose because we chose them. Like, it's an editorial decision, and I'm very happy with who we are giving our awards to.
It's definitely also interesting, yes, Cass, I think. Please. In 2025, I mean, this has been the case for many years now, but a lot of the games we played this year weren't released strictly in 2025. You know, Helldivers 2 and Darktide are two of my big titles. So it's always interesting, I think, where Game of the Year forces you to step outside of your comfort zone and, you know, not just focus on the games, I mean, certainly online games like Destiny 2 and Darktide do have some representation in our sillier categories, perhaps. But when, you know, you can easily spend all of your time playing like five games from years ago that have just been continuously updated, it's great to take a look at some of the new stuff, you know, games that you can do in one or two sittings and just see what's going on there.
My favorite thing about voting in Game of the Year every year, and it's the part of the reason why I really want to make sure that we always do it, is because it forces me, because I want to try to be comprehensive when I can, it forces me out of my comfort zone. And in the many years of Polygon, voting in Game of the Year and also just doing like guide work and getting assigned it, I found so many games and genres that I never would have touched before that I like, that are some of my favorite games. I've never played a Persona game before writing a bunch of guides for it. And now, like, I love that series and Metaphor. And I never would have, probably never would have played or touched Oberdin or something like Golden Idol. And those are like two of my favorite games of the last decade. And so, like, I hope that in, and I know in listening to Game of the Years from before I was ever in the industry, like, seeing, hearing discussions like this and hearing recommendations is how I found some of my favorite things. So hopefully someone out there is getting a similar experience. Worth something else that you mentioned, Cass, which is like our criteria for what is eligible are like online games that came out and didn't get any major updates like 2 years ago don't really count, but we don't count those for anything. But something that has like a major expansion or an update that is like substantial, we consider to be in the running. Early access games are in the running. And then anything released in December of 2024 is also in the running. This year only. We're doing later awards than we used to at Polygon. Because we don't really like having to like remember stuff that came out in December. It never does particularly well, at least in previous experiences, where we would always say like, okay, we need to vote in November, but everybody remember good stuff that comes out in December because next year it'll matter. And then Midnight Suns is a game that I really love, and then no one remembers it the next year, so nobody votes for it. We wanted to make sure we like include stuff like Indiana Jones and the Great Circle, which will come up today, and then never do December stuff again, which is why we do later awards. So next year it'll just be calendar year 2026, but this year it's 13 months because we didn't get to vote for that in our previous jobs Game of the Year. So I think that's everything in terms of like the homework to get out of the way, but
do you want to, let's run through the Rogueolis first. I'm gonna do them chronologically. So on Monday, this past Monday, a week and a half ago when you're listening to this, we did Alice's Choice. Alice gave her award to Tempest Rising, which is a base building RTS. And again, like everything you've been talking about, a game that I had never even heard of.
Yeah, it's like on my wish list.
On Tuesday, we did Cass's Choice. Cass, you gave yours to Look Outside, right?
Yes, Look Outside. Very small game that did take off. Especially if you're a horror fan, you've probably heard of this one. And the developer has been updating it post-launch as well. So, you know, it's a great time to dive in if you have yet to check it out, or if you just played it a little bit when it came out.
Yes, and we've mentioned it. This is episode 11 of our podcast. We've mentioned it at least in half of the episodes. Because
I think so, yeah.
Like, most of us just love Look Outside.
Because Look Outside and Nine Kings Ryan, are the usual suspects on this podcast.
Yes, yes. Ryan did not give your award to The Bazaar like I expected. You gave it to a little indie title
called Death Stranding 2 on the Beach. That I write about it a lot in a couple different places over this award. But I think that game hits really hard, especially like as a parent, which is so like hokey to say. But really, I do think I was almost a little bit saddened to see that, like, when the reviews came out earlier this year, that more people are writing from that perspective, because it feels so much about like a game about the deep anxiety of like losing a kid and then what happens when that comes to fruition. And that's like every parent's greatest fear. So it's I'm not somebody who's usually like emotionally shaken by stuff like that. I like it when my media shakes me up. I had at least one cutscene in that game that I had a pretty visceral reaction to and almost was like, I need to shut this off. I didn't, but that doesn't usually happen to me. So that game is, beautiful and wonderful, and I love it deeply. But also like The Bazaar is really good, and it's number two on my list, but yeah.
I, just yesterday recording this, gave my Jeff's Choice to Blueprints, like that, from day one playing that game. That game was just made for me. Like, as someone who Myst is my favorite game of all time, like, that, it just clicked for me in a lot of great ways.
Such a good game.
And today, recording this, we just published our most frustrating game.
Which, to be clear, is not a negative category. We're not yes. trying to be shitty about it. It's what it says on the tin is the game that frustrated us the most, positive or negative.
Yep. Yes, and devs certainly do like to cook up frustrating experiences at times.
Oh,
like frustrating.
Our winner knows
be.
Their game is frustrated.
Yes.
Yeah. No, this was the category that we made to give Hollow Knight Silksong an award. Even though, Ryan, I think you're the only one who finished it. I didn't even make it
up
at one, and I wrote about it.
It ended up on my personal Game of the Year list, actually, which really shocked me. But, yeah. All right, Silksong, baby.
Yep. And that's kind of what the Rogiolis, the sillier awards are for, is just the games that, I mean, for a while, we had a category called Frenchest Game that we were just going to give to Clair Obscur just to do it because it was fun. But
it is the Frenchest Game now.
That's what those are for. And we love the frustration of Hollow Knight. It just...
Yes.
Oof.
God
we did get
thing.
A little... We did get a little negative in some of our other nominees. A thing that we did not get to talk about because we are not recording our usual podcast is Ryan, you and I have both played Metroid Prime 4 : Beyond.
I'm sure we'll talk a lot about that game in January, but we've got some frustrations with it for sure.
That's a frustrating game, not because it's so difficult or exacting, but because it's so, it's weird. It's a weird game.
It's a weird
one.
It's
frustrating
we'll
in
get
a
to
lot of
January.
Unexpected ways.
Yes.
But more importantly, our actual awards, and this is where we're announcing them. This podcast will go up with our awards article.
Yes, which you can find also on the
Christmas
site at the
Eve.
Same time.
Yep. So. Go for it, Ryan.
Yeah, so we'll be starting, I'll just list out what we're going to be going over just on the rundown here. We'll be starting with Best Cozy Game, moving into Best Horror Game, then we're doing Best Co-op, Best Strategy, and then we'll end today's show with Best Action Game. Jeff, I didn't know that Myst was your favorite game of all time. I've never played Myst. We should do a stream.
I guess you
in
missed out on that one.
I did. Yeah, we should do a stream where I play Myst and just piss
teed
you
it
off.
Right up.
For the entire stream,
oh,
because I can't figure it out.
No. Oh, I played Myst within 2 years of it coming out. So, like,
when did it come out?
Not the 93, 94.
It's Myst older than I am.
Shut up. Don't. Yep. So, like, it was the full, like, slideshow version of Myst.
Oh, wow.
Funnily enough, I also played it within a couple of years of it coming out. However, I was a child, so I was like, what is this? This isn't Mario. There are no Goombas here. Ridiculous.
Yeah. It looks like I was about 6 months out from existing when Myst released.
I hate you all.
So.
Skill issue, to be quite honest with you.
Yeah,
but...
for sure. For sure. Okay. Okay. Best cozy game.
Best cozy game. Best cozy game.
I do not have a lot to contribute to this category, which is why it's a really great example when we talk about like editorial care being more important than like user votes. Some of these categories, something wins because one person really cares about it, and that's enough to carry something forward. Not that I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
But if someone else has really strong feelings about something, and I want to give, you know, we all want to give each other our places to have our passions. And this is a good spot for me to take a back seat, which was my contribution to this list, the one that I played the most of here that I really cared about, which is This Seat Taken, was one of our runner ups. A really delightful little puzzle game that I think fits into the cozy genre. It's not like a farming sim or anything like that, but it's a pretty light puzzle where you're just moving people around, where you have a certain number of like criteria of things that you can and can't do, like sit somebody next to someone else who smells because they are sensitive, or listening to music because they're trying to take a nap. Just moving people around buses and restaurants and wedding venues. It's just very, it's very chill. It feels like the perfect kind of like veg out before bed kind of game, which to me is so encapsulates like the cozy genre. So I wanted to make sure I put that on there for me.
We also had Wanderstop, which was...
Yes.
Yeah. So Wanderstop is a Davey Reedon joint. If you are not familiar with him, he was the writer behind the Stanley Parable and The Beginner's Guide, which really carved me up. So Wanderstop is interesting because it is a cozy game, but it's a cozy game with like a bit of a twist. In Stardew Valley or Palea, if you really try to min-max your way through it, the game goes, go with God, you know, have fun, like, please do so. Wanderstop is trying to tell a story about burnout and productivity and pushing yourself for the sake of it. And so it's a game that wants you to just sit and relax and not min-max, and you kind of have to meet the game on its terms, I think, to get the most out of it. But I did find it to be a really just pleasant, thoughtful little game, which is why I nominated it for our cozy games.
Yeah, one of my nominations was Plan B Terraform. I think I talked about it on here a long time ago.
Yes.
Which is an unexpectedly cozy game, because colony sim, base building sims are not really cozy. They tend to be panicky and try to keep everybody from dying games. But Plan B Terraform doesn't make you do that, and it just lets you focus on building out infrastructure and like playing with the new technologies you unlock. And it turns it into a really like a really chill experience, as opposed to like, oh my god, everybody's dying.
The colony builds itself, excuse me, I mean, you set it up, but it does a lot of the work automated, and that, like, when you compare and contrast that with something like Surviving Mars Remastered from like a couple months later, it's just like a completely night and day experience. It's much more just like working 100%. Towards a goal where you can't really fail, whereas like Surviving Mars is there to kick you in the dick over and over again until you decide you're done getting kicked in the dick or you're going to kick back. And Plan B does a much better job at that. Not all of these are like, and this was my nomination, but it does kind of work out in this one. I know Tiny Bookshop was one that was really important to Alice, and much beloved by her. I have not played it. Has anyone else here played it? I know Alice had a great interview very early on in Rogue about it.
Yeah,
I've dabbled with it a little, but I think vendor games are such a fun little niche. You know, you're running a store, you're taking care of people, and you can't really go wrong with your recommendations. Like, you definitely want to get people the right thing, but if you fail and get them something, they're not mad about it. It's all very kind of just low key. It's the sort of thing where, as a reader, it's really easy just to get lost in there, which I very much appreciate.
Yeah, it's like most wholesome game. But our winner is also one that I didn't touch this year, but I would still like to, because I liked its predecessor. But Strange Antiquities was our winner for this year's category.
And Strange Antiquities is the sequel to Strange Horticulture. Another kind of vendor game, but with the twist of you don't actually know much about what you're selling and what you're giving away until you figure it out from various clues and books and everything else. And Strange Antiquities just takes that and takes that great premise. Strange Horticulture is a great game. Strange Antiquities takes that premise and just makes it bigger and more for a sequel in wonderful ways. And that's why it won our Best Cozy Game.
It's definitely a little more sinister than you might expect from the cozy genre, but I quite like that. I think cozy, you know, sometimes it's great just to be farming berries and making jams. And sometimes it's nice to have something with a little more, you know, you're like delving into these secrets. People want things that certainly sure it's wise for them to have. You're in some pursuit of some perhaps forbidden knowledge. But like, I think that freedom to be a little bit, you know, on the sinister side of things, to be a little bit perhaps less than benevolent with the knowledge you're accruing is a really fun twist in and of itself. Which is a fun way, I think, game. To segue into best horror, because that is a very sinister absolutely. Genre.
Yeah, Strange Antiquities does kind of flow nicely into Best Horror this year, certainly for some of the games that we have nominated. I'll hit up with the one that I ended up placing on here, which also made this on ways all the way into Best Most Frustrating, which I've talked to you about on the podcast, which is Chronos the New Dawn, which is the Bloober Team survival horror game, the brand new like IP from the same people who were like remade Silent Hill 2, or the same studio at the very least. And it's like a very Polish game where you run around as a time traveling like robot lady fighting zombie monsters. And it really does fit nicely into that Resident Evil fairy Dead Spacey pantheon, which when you look at like that genre, there's just not much happening out there outside of like the usual suspects of Resident Evil. And it was basically only Resident Evil for a really long time. And Silent Hill is only just now getting back into it. So it's just nice seeing a new one of these. The reason it made it onto most frustrating is that some of the game feels like it's designed to have something like a dodge roll, but you're so slow. And that both works in its horror favor and also just like enraged me on like two of the bosses near the end. That feel like they just charge you from behind. But it's still a really great horror game and was one of my favorites that I played this year that kind of is best played in the dark without lights on.
And
it has definitely been good to see Bloober. Ah, yes, Silent Hill F, which was quite a surprise.
Sorry,
in
I didn't
and
mean
of
to
itself,
interrupt you,
Silent Hill F. No, no, you're good. I was just saying, someone who has played a bunch of Bloober's earlier games, a lot of it really comes down to its trauma, which I feel like Chronos and Silent Hill 2, obviously Silent Hill 2 deals with trauma, but there is a bit more subtlety, a lot more nuance to the way it is handled, which is refreshing. And Silent Hill F is definitely a game with subtlety and nuance in spades. This is a controversial game for Silent Hill fans simply because the combat is quite robust, much more than you might expect. Like, Kanako is running around 1960s Japan just beating the shit out of monsters with a lead pipe, with a ceremonial spear, with anything she can get her hands on. And that, combined with the fact that this is a game where in order to really get into it and dig into everything it has on display, you are going to have to New Game Plus it, you know, a few times. So Silent Hill F is a game where it's not for everyone. For some people, I would just be like, you're good to play it once and then YouTube it. But I really love just digging into this and like finding all the nuances in the relationships, finding where the game ties to the rest of the Silent Hill franchise and what that means for the plot. And, you know, just the new setting. I think small town Maine is a fun setting. It's certainly not one I have anything against, but we have been there. We have been to many small, foggy American towns. I think this was a very good, fresh take on the franchise. I think it's one that moves it towards its strengths as an anthology series, as opposed to being the story of this one cult and this one girl and so on. All in all, I was really surprised and impressed with Silent Hill F. Really pleasant surprise this year.
I can't remember if Silent Hill F made it onto my "it's on my list, I swear" award list, but
it's on mine.
If it isn't, I'm going to add it.
We also have Look Outside, of course, which is a game that I hyped in many categories, specifically for the horror genre. I'm just going to say the body horror in this game is unmatched. It's quite cartoony, pixelated, and for some people that might kill the vibe. But, like, I have seen photorealistic gore a million times. It does nothing for me. The really inventive, clever designs, I think, they really stuck with me in a way that horror game designs don't always. A lot of horror game monsters are, it's a guy with something weird's going on his head, like he's got a TV or a siren or a dog head there. So seeing these, like, brilliant, original, scary-ass monsters was a treat.
Yeah, I think the body horror in Look Outside is top-notch. Like you said, it's pixelated. It's, probably closer to 16-bit art. But, like, the designs are just so unsettling, especially in that cartoony style, that it's just such a delight. A different kind of horror. My nomination in this one was Static Dread The Lighthouse, which I have talked about kind of at every opportunity. Just a really, like, crunchy PS1 style cosmic horror game where you're just helping ships navigate a harbor just in the shadow of Lovecraftian cosmic unexplained horror in the background. And lighthouses are creepy to begin with, and it's such a lonely and weird and unexplained horror that I love that game. And while I was talking about how much I love that game, they announced a sequel already, so I am pumped about that. Yeah, Static Dread, right. The Submarine, something like that.
I think we can agree the ocean is a sinister place best avoided.
Yes, yep. 100%. I love spooky water shit. It's like my absolute favorite. Dastophobia stuff is the most fun. Static Dread, The Lighthouse is definitely like an on my list. Kind of thing, but like genuinely the thing that is the top of my list in terms of like finish it, because I played a little bit of it and it's a ton of fun, and it's very fascinating, it's also right up my alley, is our winner for this category, which is The Seance of Blake Manor, which is a kind of like, I would say it fits into the genre of an Oberdin, Return of the Oberdin, or a Golden Idol like game. Absolutely love those deduction-based puzzle games. And the idea of Seance of Blake Manor is you're basically looking, you're a detective, and like, it's like, I'm going to butcher the time period, but it's like long time ago, like horse and buggy era, like Ireland.
1890s, I believe.
And 18-somethings?
1890s.
1890s.
And you're like traveling to a hotel where a bunch of spooky people are staying because there's about to be a seance and you're looking for a woman who's disappeared. And it has some really great like mechanics in there to investigate things, which takes up time in your day, and then adds it to your journal, and then you can talk to people about it. It's got a real, like, kind of like classic point and click adventure, but in a more like 3D space walk around type of game, almost like Blueprints in a way. It's really kind of a mix of a lot of different great things like that this year, and takes stuff like, you know, The Root Trees Are Dead, which is another investigative game from earlier this year that I really love, that I wish if there were fewer really amazing games this year would be on a lot of lists for me, but just didn't quite make the cut. I just adore these kind of games, and I didn't have the time when it came out to really invest the time into it to really get fully there. But everyone on staff just loved it, and it was like, it was a pretty clear win by when we got to, it was not every category was like, oh, this is the one that wins, but when we got to Sands of Blake Manor, it was like, no, everyone seems to agree this is the one.
Yeah. Blake's up from Sands of Blake Manor, I think, is really elevated by its cast. You have a lot of people, and they have relationships. Some of them are professional rivals, some are lovers, some are exes. And that causes a lot of just drama inherent to things that I really enjoy. And a lot of the deduction comes from those personalities. You know, who's a fraud? Who's for real? Who thinks they're for real, but like is just kind of faking it? Who is legitimately a dangerous occultist here and who is just talking the good game? That, to me personally, is just a more fun puzzle to work out than, oh no, this heart key is in the west wing, but it's guarded by a pit, so I need to go get a plank from the workshop in order to cross it, and then I can open the heart doors, which, you know, no shame to that. That is the backbone of many a Resident Evil.
Yeah.
But Seance is a little less of a puzzle game and more of a mystery thriller horror. So very enjoyable in my experience, very much worth checking out.
It's not for the way of like a jump scare situation either. It's just, it's all vibes based horror. It's just a spooky game that's like a great thing to like play at 2 a.m. during a thunderstorm is like the perfect setup for that.
Sorry. Oh, yeah. No, I just wanted to say, I think what elevates Seance of Blake Manor is both everything that Cash just said, like the depth of the investigation and the richness of the investigation and the clues you find. But then you couple it with a really unexpected and punishing, like, timer mechanic. Like, it's, you can't wander around and gather every clue. You have to, like, at the very beginning, you have to be out of the manager's office before he comes back, or you lose the game. Like, there are stakes, and while I don't always love a timer in a game, I prefer to take my time. It changes the investigation game into, just adds this tension to it that adds
this
to
was just a,
the
yeah.
tension of the game as a whole.
Yeah, this was just a stacked year for horror, I think. Routine is a game where if it had come out, you know, a couple of months earlier, it probably would have been much higher on my lists. No, I'm Not a Human. Raw Fury and Critical Reflex are two smaller publishers that have just been putting out banger after banger after banger in the horror genre. So this was a competitive one, but I'm quite happy with our final results.
Yeah, for sure. Moving into our best co-op game, this is one that sent us all reeling with the realization that like Repo came out this year. It's been a weird year, and a lot of stuff has happened, but it's been a real spread of co-op games from like, I feel like some of these are summer and back of the year heavy lists, and there's like co-op feels very spread out. Something that is from the like Big Friendly Guide era of Rogue for me that I put on here was Absalom, which is a side-scrolling roguelite beat 'em up game which is like, I'm not a huge beat 'em up person. I played, you know, the Simpsons game at our local, my local pizza joint, but I never expected to like fall in love with one quite like this, other than like a single playthrough. The Man of Solomon does such a great job of making its world interesting and also like fun and cool to share with a friend, which is like such the, so many of these roguelites that are so good are very isolation based games where it's all about you being Malinowe in Hades 2 and going ham on everything around you as a one woman army. And Absalom is like, we're going to give you a lot of fun powers and then we're going to let you team up with a friend and fuck shit up together. And that's like such a cool and delightful experience. And this really lovely and interesting world is a great game. And I feel like it had to be on this list. For me, it was an easy inclusion.
Yeah. And Absalom's going to keep coming up in various categories.
Not the last time we'll talk about Absalom.
Yeah. But
today,
it does have to be noted, like, Absalom is just so gorgeous. Like, the cartoon style is just so perfect. And it makes me wish
we had a best looking game category.
Yeah.
It is the thing that convinced me that maybe that's next year that needs to be a category. Because, like, goddamn, every time I wrote about it for our Game of the Year stuff, I somehow could not get past it without talking about how gorgeous that game looks.
But that's a really good category. I like that.
Jot down a note. Set reminder for October 30th, 2026.
Yeah. One game that won't be discussed in the other categories, but Jeff, I'm really interested to hear your thoughts on, was Firebreak, where we are the opposites in that I have played the Controls and the Alan's Wake and what have you, whereas Firebreak was your introduction to this sort of universe proper.
That's such a crime.
It is. It's a crime. It was my introduction. This is a little weird as a category because my experience with FBC Firebreak was, I think, maybe 2 days. Like, I am not a big co-op online game person to begin with, but Ryan and I and Toussaint, who is one of the kind of founding members of Rogue, spent a long Saturday just playing Firebreak, and it was so good. Like, it was just so much fun, such a, so many of the team shooter games are just really simple. Like, it is a team of people and they do shooting, and FBC Firebreak really feels like it gives each role a distinct role beyond bigger gun. And Firebreak was just a really, really well made game. I need to play Control. I really, and Alan Wake.
You do, especially now that Control 2 got announced.
I don't want to talk to you after the holidays unless you've played Alan Wake 2. Like, I cannot describe to you how much that game is in your wheelhouse. And knowing you for a very long time, you have to play Alan Wake 2, Jeff.
Alan Wake 1, you can YouTube. That one's okay.
It's a great game.
It hasn't aged quite as well.
Yes.
Yes, 100%. There's a villain who every time he shows up calls Alan Wake another derogatory writer name, which is perfect. Hey, Hemingway, enough of you, Shakespeare. And he says like 20 times a different writer each time. It's perfect.
Amazing.
Love
sincerely, just watch a YouTube video and then start Alan Wake 2. It's so, 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 so good. You will love it.
Cass, your recommendation is Jump Space. I only played like minutes of the demo, so I'm really curious what that has become as a co-op game.
So I come to Jump Space as a Sea of Thieves fan who kind of fell out of love with Sea of Thieves. When Sea of Thieves launched, and like to this day even, being a crew on a ship is a lot of fun. You know, like you're jumped by a skeleton ship and you got to patch up holes. You have to keep up with your supplies. You're getting treasure. You're getting rich. But unfortunately, the PvP in that game, getting jumped was just such a viscerally unpleasant experience that Rare really has just been like, no, this is central to our game. You are going to deal with it. Jump space captures a lot of what I really love about Sea of Thieves. Like, you're on a ship with your pals, you're running around, you're like, oh, I gotta get this fire out, someone's gotta get on the guns to take out this enemy ship. So it has that sort of cooperative vehicle based that has shown up in things like Warframe's Railjack mode, or RV yet there yet, or honestly, I feel like a lot of games recently, Pacific Drive even, are about just the joy of maintaining and having your own little vehicle. But definitely, Jump Space has all of that, plus the ability where you pull up to a station, you go aboard, you're looting. So it has those high action moments of risk. Oh, you know, what's going to be aboard here? What are we going to walk out of? Are we going to come out richer? Or I hope we don't, you know, encounter something we can't walk away from. And you may have to melt down some of that, those rare treasures that you have obtained because you just simply failed to keep your ship safe. So it is the sort of co-op game where there is downtime where you're chatting with your pals. Everyone's just kind of doing their own role on the ship and it's not intense. And then there's the, you know, everyone's locked in, calling out rotations and targets and very high stakes. And it doesn't, you know, reinvent any wheels on this regard. It's just a really smooth experience of jumping between various forms of co-op play in a sci-fi setting that overall really impressed me. It is an early access title. I believe it's like $25 right now. But it was definitely a very pleasant surprise, especially if you are into the sort of game like Void Crew or Star Trek Bridge Crew. I think this would be your jam as well.
You know, our last runner-up is one that I added on the list and was briefly interrogated on the purpose of it being there. And it's very simple. It's Fellowship. And that game is great and a super fun co-op experience because it manages to do something I think is very impressive, which is it captures one of the best parts of a really complex ecosystem game like World of Warcraft, which is the Mythic Plus Dungeons. And it distills just that aspect of the game as the entire play system experience. And so you don't need to go in and like level up your character and do all this other bullshit, which I love to do in WoW. I love to do that bullshit. But it's becoming harder and harder to do the things I want to do, like Mythic Pluses in WoW, because I just don't have as much time to do all that other stuff. And so Fellowship was able to give me that like that hit of a dungeon experience, but with really minimal impact to my overall time. I can just get in there and play it. And it nails that feel so perfectly. I couldn't imagine it not being on this list. So I want to make sure Fellowship got on there. The Chaos, one of your favorite games of the year, is our winner.
Yeah.
Yes, it is peak. And I think friend slop has become a popular term for, you know, when your buddies jump on and they're like, you have to check out this new game. We all work at a supermarket together. Or it's like Lethal Company. But something's different this time. And Peak is, in some ways, it is friend slop, which I say in the kindest way possible because it's very, very fun. The proximity chat while you're all climbing up the mountain leads to just perfect moments where you're like, where's our friend? And then you just hear a distant scream in the background. If you die, you can become a helpful ghost and still be a team player, a little bit of a spectral walkie-talkie. Climb dicks, I feel like, are just big right now. You had Baby Steps, you have Care coming out, Peak, Chained Together. There's a million more I'm not mentioning, but I think Peak just really captures the fun of, like, collaborating with friends, climbing, dropping ropes, working together, but also just the chaos of what happens when you do split up. Oh no, a skeletal scoutmaster is chasing you down. Oh no, your friend ate some poison berries and now you gotta haul him up the mountain. There are enough of these delightful little complications that really just make Peak such a great co-op title that I would recommend to like people who aren't necessarily gamers. I wouldn't recommend Jump Space to my immediate family, but I would Peak. And I think that is great.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
And Peak is what we played on our first stream. So yeah, that was a lot of fun. Next category is a very single player game category.
Yes. We're going to do
and
best
unfortunately,
strategy, but first we're going to take
Alice
a little bit of a quick
here.
Break.
Okay.
Yes. We do have to take a quick break before we get into best strategy, but then we will be back to chat about a bunch of great games, including some of the games that Alice put on here that are some beloved ones. I think Alice and I really contributed a lot to this category. I had a real strategy heavy year, so we'll get into all those when we come right back from the break, which will be no time at all for you. See you in a second. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to part one of our Game of the Year chat. I'm wearing different clothes now, and we stopped off at best strategy game. But sorry if there's any weird like lag stuff. I don't think that should come through on your end, other than us stepping on each other a little bit. We had a little bit of a lag in the first half, but I think it's doing better now, so bear with us. But I think we're in a better spot. Best strategy game is... I feel like I look at this, and I'm like, this is... largely an Alice and Ryan juncture on this list, but I think we all have played at least some of these. Cass, are you familiar with Warhammer 40K Dawn of War Definitive Edition?
So not so much the Definitive Edition. The Dawn of War series in general, I have experienced some. It's definitely a very flavorful, character-filled RTS, and it did a lot for getting a wave of fans into 40K. So definitely it is the sort of game where I can see it has aged quite well and a remaster seems quite appropriate. But with Dawn of War 4 coming next year, I believe.
I forgot that's happening.
Yeah, it's great to have an opportunity to go back to where it began and check it out.
Is that who's the developer on that one? Was Relic one of the original? Is that the right name? Am I remembering correctly? Did the originals or?
Made the remaster, right?
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
See, Dawn
Relic
of War
has a long history with 40K and war games in general.
Funnily enough, Dawn of War 2, I think, was my first introduction to Warhammer 40K. And I did not realize it at the time, what Warhammer 40K was or what Warhammer was in general. I just thought they looked like rad stormtrooper dudes. And I bought it. And I didn't end up playing that much of it because I'm like, this isn't Galactic Battlegrounds. But it was probably a little too strategic for me at the time. But I think like years later when I was finally introduced like properly to whatever 40K was, I was like, oh, I recognize these weird looking dudes with the vents in their helmets. That's from that Dawn of War game. And now it's weird to see we're still only on 4 all these years later. But it's King Art, which I'm not familiar with.
I'm looking at their the list of games and I do not recognize them.
Yeah, interesting. I thought, I wonder what Relic's up to. Relic did Company of Heroes, right?
I don't know.
This is a conversation for a different podcast. Yep. But the Dawn of War series is rad. And I'm super glad to see. I love seeing, like, in a sea of new games that are all like fresh to us. It's really lovely sometimes to see something classic still be able to make the list, like a Definitive Edition for Dawn of War. So shout out to Warhammer 40K. I'll just talk about the Bazaar right now. I'll get it out of the way. This has been like my soapbox game for all year. I started playing it in January, and it like consumed me. I wrote in at least one of the entries for one of the many Game of the Year blogs that I wrote, but like I haven't really experienced something that has like I've become obsessed with is the bizarre since my obsession with League of Legends in college, which was so intense for me and our fellow former coworker Austin Goslin that when we were backpacking through Europe together during college, we had to stop in a an internet cafe to play a couple League of Legends games in Paris, I think.
Oh, goodness.
It was fun. It was a fun, weird experience. I'd never been to an internet cafe before, and now I have, and I've played League there. You know, we went to, like, Germany. We went to, like, the LCS pro games in Germany, too, and everything. Like, it was a... I was hot and heavy with League, and that's how Cass and I met before we ever did in Canada, in the only time I've ever been to Canada, and then also before we ever, that's how my career started. So I don't think it's going to happen with the Bizarre, but I do love it in that same like obsessive way. It's like, it's the kind of thing I wish was easier to describe because I feel like I've just tried to describe it 50,000 different ways. I haven't quite gotten something there yet, but the developers call it like a hero builder roguelite, where it's not quite a deck builder, but the general idea is you go to shops, like there's like an in-game days take like 6 hours, and you go to shops and buy items, and then you put those items on your limited space board, and they have synergies together that go off and then trigger one another, and some deal damage and some deal status effects or whatever. And you fight like monsters at the midpoint of the day to test your build or to try to get better items. And at the end of the day, you fight a like asynchronous PvP match against another player. And it's just so good. And I think it's the type of thing that if it was like just Hearthstone Battlegrounds or TFT, it's like a hard thing for me to play at the moment because like, I might need to get up and do something for my kid. But with the Bizarre, because everything is asynchronous, it really has kind of enabled me to sit there and dissociate while we're watching Bluey for the 100th time and still allow me to like get up and get my kid a snack or whatever. It's an amazing game. It's hard to get into, but like if you can get over that barrier and start to appreciate it, like, for every friend that I've tried to get into it, I've gotten another friend into it successfully. I think as far as staff members, Clayton is the only one I've gotten hot and heavy, but he's hard into it. I'm always looking for converts, but it's a really, really special game.
I think that like friction getting into it is what made me bounce off of it. Like it's not immediately obvious how it works and the effort required to get as into it as you are.
Yes.
Is.
Oh, yeah.
A bit much for me.
We would need to have taken time to like sit down and maybe we'll do this someday. I mean, I think Clayton and I talked about it at some point, but then he got too good at the game, and now we're probably an even footing at this point, so it's not as fun. But, like, it's the kind of game where you need to, like, I watched, like, streamers play, and that taught me a bunch about it, but, like, I sucked for a long time. And then I got good at it, and then it's really fun, but it's definitely the kind of thing that is, like, it rewards a lot of different types of skills, and when you can get to a place where you have deep knowledge of how the game works and you're also thinking creatively about what the game is giving to you and allowing you to do interesting things, and also you're thinking in a strategic standpoint of being flexible as well, like it rewards all of those kind of things that you see for high rolling and pivoting and all this other stuff that's it's just really nice, and the production value is really great, and man, now it is on Steam especially, it's an easy sell, and I cannot recommend the Bizarre enough. It's just got to be a little patient with it. But yeah, the Bizarre, great game. Cataclysmo is something that is on my absolutely must playlist, and I actually just bought it in a Steam sale. Has anyone but Alice played this? I know what it is, but
Unfortunately, no. It looks like a really fun, I think tower defense is kind of not on the outs per se, but it's not a particularly popular genre. So it's cool to see a take on it.
Yeah.
With like the, you know, the stance of you got to build your defenses up medieval style. It's much, you know, more focused on micromanaging your strategies as opposed to just click spamming a million projectiles. But it does look quite interesting, and it is a game I will have to check out in 2026.
Yeah, the art style is beautiful. I definitely compared it a little bit to when talking to Alice about it before I ended up buying it in the Steam. I think I already said that. And Steam sales, I'm excited to jump into it. But I compared it a little bit to They Are Billions from a couple of years ago, that zombie game where you build like your own zombie shelter and you just get bombarded by a bunch of enemies and stuff. And Alice was quick to point out that it is better than They Are Billions in her opinion. But the art is gorgeous for it. And like if you go look at like the Steam clips and stuff, you're literally like building out your own like Lego castle. And when we were talking to Alice about it, she was talking about going and like looking up like Norman castles and stuff and like what they did to push back, make their castle more secure and have better like archer vantage points and stuff like that. And I don't know if you got to be that extra about it. Maybe you do though. But it's just it's a really, if nothing else, it's a gorgeous looking game. And it's from Digital Sun, the same developer that makes Moonlighter and Moonlighter 2. And that first Moonlighter is really a real treasure. So I'm very much looking forward to getting into that. Our last nominee before we get to our winner, though, is Starbirds, which is something that, Jeff, we played over the summer.
Yep.
With that Next Fest. And it is adorable. I don't know how much you've played the full release. But it's very cute and a delightful little management sim.
Yeah. I played a little bit more, but I haven't had as much chance to go back to it as I want. But it's a game developed with I will butcher the name because it's an impossible name, Kurzikstog, which is a wonderful YouTube channel.
It's made by the Dwarf Romantic people.
Yep. And Starbirds is, it's just a management sim. It's slightly less cozy, but it's another cozy management sim that's, you know, cutesy birds in space mining asteroids. And like, it's really freeform and nice, big, colorful shapes. It's a really cute and satisfying game.
Yeah. And like the cool thing about it is it's like stage based, like galaxy based. And you're really building out like an ecosystem in the system that you're currently in. So it's not as much that you're just like, I'm mining this asteroid. It's like, well, I'm mining all of the planetoids in this one section, and then I'm sending different pieces to different planets and to different, you know, some stuff I'm sending back to the mothership, but some stuff I'm actually sending instead to this other asteroid where I have a refinery where I'm then taking pieces. I'm sending pieces out, but I'm also taking pieces in to then combine with other things to send a different, more advanced thing out as well. It's really cute. It's also like everyone's an adorable little bird, and like toucans and all sorts of different types. And it's simultaneously like very cute. It's like the right amount of complicated to not get too annoyed or frustrating. And it's also like there's a little bit of actions per minute in terms of like you can get, if you run out of stuff, you can like run around a little rover and collect it in a fun little way. It obviously, like, because it's the Dwarf Romantic people, it looks gorgeous and it's bright and colorful and like the pastel colors are just beautiful. And it's a really fun little game. Starbirds, check it out.
Yep.
But our winner of this category is another one of my absolute favorite games of the year. That I feel like Jeff and you and I have been talking about since the BFG days, and yes. Nine Kings, which when we first started playing it, when it first came out at the end of May, which is a really weird time for all of us,
Yep.
It was called Nine Kings, but it only had seven kings.
Oh, that's right.
Part of the reason this wins for me and why I was so adamant about it is what SadSocket, the developer, has done with their early access period is one of the more impressive early accesses that I've seen in recent years. Like, it feels we're currently on the 20th patch, and it came out at the end of May. And typically those patches come with like not insubstantial changes to them. And like in the time since I got it, they've added the eighth king, then they added which was the king of nomads, and then the ninth king. And then they've added this whole quest mode, which is really delightful and fun and kind of throws you into these special scenarios. But the game at its heart is like very simple. Like, you start with a 3x3 grid of your kingdom, and you play as a king that has a certain type of cards that you can get, and those cards represent units or buffs or buildings that you can place onto these grids. And every time, if you have three or more cards, you play until you have two or less. And then once you have two or fewer cards in your hand, the match starts, and it plays against AI at difficulties that you can scale. And it just plays a battle between you and one of the opposing two kings that you're at war with, or the rebellion of your own faction. And then if you lose a life, and that takes place, every battle is like consumes a year of time. But if you win, you're able to then pick a card from your opponent's deck. And so basically you're combining buildings and units and magic cards of all of these different kingdoms together in this really fun and what feels like a limitless way, where like, you know, the king of nothing, like the starting king, might have a unit like the soldier that gets more and more powerful gradually as you add units to it, which is great because the king of nothing's buildings is the farm, which adds a unit to an adjacent troop every turn. But the King of Nothing also has the Paladin card, which is a character that gains bonus damage based off of how much health they have. And the King of Nothing doesn't really have a great way to scale their health, but if you pair them with like the Forest card from the King of Nature, which gives any adjacent card health, you're able to then stack up this huge amount of damage on these paladin characters, and you can also put those next to a farm. And so you have like 80 paladins by year 33, which is when it ends. And they all do crazy amounts of damage. And then you can keep playing beyond when the match ends. And it warns you that like the game gets a lot more unstable as it gets scaled up, and then you can get into years, the hundreds, and then you have like thousands of units or like tiny little rat creatures running around. And I have a good PC where the only modern game I have not been able to run very well is Borderlands 4, a notoriously badly optimized game. And Nine Kings has crashed my PC multiple times. Not because it's badly optimized, but because I had thousands of rats simulating a battle all at once.
Mm-hmm.
And
beautiful.
It would freeze my entire thing. It's awesome. It is the perfect level of like deceptively simple that grows into something that is truly like limitless feeling. And the quest mode they just added took me from somebody who had played 50 hours in the game, just playing the normal mode matches over and over again, and kind of stuck to the same kinds of cards. And it helped teach me, even somebody with so much time in the game, the value of every single card in the game. And now I'm able to do so much more than I ever could before, just because of the challenges that it's put forth on me. It's one of my favorite early access experiences in such a long time. And I cannot wait to see what they do in the new year, where there's like a ranked mode coming, which I don't even know what that looks like. But even if we just stopped here, the like 100 hours, I've literally 100 hours I've gotten in this game, is an easy sell already. And apparently an easy enough sell that, like, too much to my surprise, when we started talking about best strategy, multiple people here were like, it feels like Nine Kings is gonna win, because I mean, Cass, you just heard Jeff and I gush about it so much.
Yeah, as someone who is not too much of a strategy person, like, I'll indulge in the RTS here and there. Listening to you two just praise Nine Kings definitely made me realize, like, you know, it is a game that really has legs, you know, because this wasn't just once or twice. I think probably like half a dozen times we have gone into the nitty gritty of Nine Kings, which makes me feel like, you know, it's quite deserving of this reward.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like it's just such, it's so much fun to break it and get those huge numbers Ryan was talking about. It's like you said, it's a nice, simple game. It's not overwrought. It's not bloated. It's just, you know, simple rules that you manipulate to make big number. And it's just really fun. It's a really good game.
Yeah. If the Bazaar is a game that has a ridiculously high ceiling to get into it, and then just expands infinitely upwards, Nine Kings has, I think, a deceptively low floor, or has like a low floor that leads to a deceptively high ceiling. It's very accessible. It's really easy to get into. The easiest difficulties are like very hard to fail. It gives you a lot, and then the way it scales up is really nice and challenging, and the quest mode is really intense and asks you to like really try to express all the things that you've learned about the game along your way, and it tries to teach you as well. It is I'm still learning from the game and what I can do better, and I've beaten the game on like the max difficulty setting with multiple different characters, and I hope they keep teaching me stuff, because it's just such a fun thing to revisit. Nine Kings, as much as I love the Bazaar, it's a much easier recommendation than the Bazaar is.
Absolutely.
But yeah, it's number three on my game of the year. So great, great, great game. Which leads us to our final category of the day. Best action game, which is so nebulous. Like, what is an action game in 2025? Yeah. Other than like, we're like, is Clair Obscur an action game? Like, kind of, because there's inputs midpoint, but we settled on some other greats. We're not going to talk too much about it again, but just to get it out of the way here up at the top, Absalom makes it on this list. We talked about that a little bit earlier in the show. Just a great, impressive enough that like, I don't think the beat 'em up genre feels great classically. Like, it's something that it feels fun when you're like playing with your friends, when you're high on pizza, when you're 10. But it's something where it's, for me at least, as somebody who's not like a big Double Dragon person or whatever, it is more of a Turtles in Time kind of guy. It's the kind of thing where you spend a lot of time mashing against an enemy and being like, why am I not? Oh, I'm off a pixel? God damn it. And that's not the kind of thing that I would want to grind my head against on like a roguelite that demands precision, accuracy, and skill growth like they all do. But Absalom takes that minute-to-minute action and really kills it in a way that makes me actually want to replay this genre that I typically am more of a tourist for. Which is in itself is just super impressive. So Absalom, one of our runners up for this category.
Next just up on the list going... is
tell you
yeah,
guys.
I was just gonna say, you know, the Switch 2. We had Donkey Kong Bonanza, which was kind of a surprise from my point of view. I haven't heard people rave about a Donkey Kong game in recent years, but Jeff, you really enjoyed this one, right?
I enjoyed it. Ryan enjoyed it more than me.
I'm the Donkey Kong stick out here in more ways than one. But
it is,
Jeff, please.
It is. I would say, I think hands down the best game that's come out for the Switch 2. It is just so much fun. It's a Nintendo game. I mean, Nintendo knows what they're doing, and they just made this big, dumb, fun, smash the world Donkey Kong game. Like, that's what it is. It's a Nintendo game, and it's Nintendo doing everything that they do so well, really well.
Yeah, I mean, like, those of us who've been, like, Donkey Kong sickos and fiends for years, people who were, like, in the minds of Donkey Kong 64 isn't as bad as you remember, and I played it this year, and that's, what a great, terrible game. But, I mean, I never thought, like, Mario won, man, like, it was never gonna happen. I was like, you know, we're gonna get 2D Donkey Kong games, like, Tropical Freeze and Country Returns, and we're going to like it. And that's all there's really ever going to be. And it's so delightful to see DK, this character with like so much personality, always had so much personality, to have him be like redesigned away from like the broody douchebag that he was in DK 64. And then he kind of is in the Mario movie, but in a more fun way. He's more of a dipshit in that movie. Than the like swanky cool DK that you get in 64. But just having this be like this lovable oaf that is slightly smarter than some of the other simian characters in the game, like very lightly. It's so charming, and it's like gorgeous looking. It is, I mean, to me, it's like you said, like it's the system seller. It's the thing that like, If I can recommend one, you know, Mario Kart World is controversial. Metroid Prime 4 didn't live up to expectations for me, at least. I think Kirby Air Riders is neat, but like, if somebody were to get Donkey, or if somebody were to get a Switch 2, the easiest and quickest recommendation is Donkey Kong Bonanza. And it's so like creative and unique and interesting. It's nice to see Nintendo make something big and expansive that doesn't ape.
ape too hard.
I see what you did there. Yes, yeah.
Thank you. Hey, thanks so much, you guys. Doesn't ape too hard on on Breath of the Wild, which is what Nintendo has been riffing on the success of for like a decade. And it's not that Donkey Kong Bonanza doesn't have any of that DNA, it totally does. But it feels unique. It feels like this could be. And not only that, it differentiates itself from Mario. Like, I think if we get a, you know, fingers crossed, a new 3D Mario from the other half of that team, at least that's what we think is happening. Who knows? We'll listen back on this next year and all look like idiots, but, or I will at least. But if we get that 3D Mario that everyone's thinking we're going to get that next year, they did such a good job with Bonanza that I don't think it's going to feel tired. It's gonna, because they differentiated it. They were like, what is the skill set of this giant gorilla that is different than the plump Italian man. And as a plump Italian man myself, like, I'm not a whole lot like a gorilla. So it's nice to see them do something different and not just make like another goofy platformer in a different universe. It's like a Red Faction game instead, because he's strong, he's Smash, and like, that is so impressive to me for a company that does things typically very safe, because the things that they do when they're safe are great.
Yep.
It is nice to see them go out on a ledge and make something that is like inherently janky.
Yeah.
And just go for it. And they kill it. Plus, they've indicated all the King K. Rule stands out there. And I'm just personally very happy about that. That history of King K. Rool boss fights that we launched the site with is still one of my favorite things I've written in the past couple of years. So, yeah, Donkey Kong Bonanza, great, great, great game. The easiest and quickest recommendation for people when they get a Switch 2. Delightful.
So I'm going to need you two to talk about Megabonk, because
yes, please.
While everybody says that it's really good, I think I'm too old and just too turned off from it. I can't
necessarily know if Megabonk is like for me, Megabonk is goofy. We can acknowledge that straight up. This is a game where one of the unlockable characters is a skeleton with sunglasses riding a skateboard. This is a game where there's a guy who just aura farms. His ability is literally called Aura. He is Mega Chad, and he just strolls around logging on everyone around him. And there are people who are going to go, what is this fucking Reddit humor, big chungus ass game? And you know what? If you're that sort of person, I understand. Go with God, my friend. But I like skeletons with sunglasses. You know, that's just my where I stand on this controversial issue. Megabonk is really an inheritor of like the survivors genre, except it adds a third element. You know, it's got the third dimension. You're jumping. You get double jumps, triple jumps. Some characters are much more vertically mobile. Some can climb walls. Like I mentioned, one of them has a skateboard. That is my favorite character. He is legitimately so fun to play. And you just go around, you're shooting bosses, you're shooting goblins, you're shooting skeletons, you're going to shrines to unlock new powers and weapons. And yeah, it is deeply silly. This is a no-brain, head-empty game. And I quite like that because sometimes I just want to be a skeleton on a skateboard killing thousands of goblins with a revolver and a banana. That's just something that I think is a good thing to unwind with. And the survivors genre is also just really inherently built to like just stick around with, just spend a few hours running around a screen, throwing out projectiles. And Megabonk does just a really good job of keeping that flow going, of trickling out new unlocks. So just when you think you've hit the ceiling of absurdity, there's something new for you to take a look at, a new character, some new power-up or weapon. And it's just really a solid core gameplay loop of running around a big open field and taking out these encroaching armies. And it's definitely, the humor, again, is not for everyone. I'm very aware of that. But if you are either able to tolerate it or even accept it in your heart, I mean, it's a little bit like Captain Underpants for adults, you know? Like, you know it's goofy. If you see a clown, are you going to make fun of him for having big shoes and a red nose? Or are you simply going to go, that clown is clowning to the best of their ability? That's a bonk.
Holy shit, the Captain Underpants thing is such a, they're so good. That's so true. It is so like, yeah, it's, it makes me feel so old every time I play it. And, but also it's so fun as like addition to that, the vampire survivors like Pantheon and doing it in a way that's like different. Which is nice. Like, it's just nice to see something like innovate on that, even if it's very it's very like clear in what it's doing. Jeff, tell us about Indiana Jones, one of our favorite games.
Indiana Jones came out in December, which is why it's on our list. We talked about this, and we couldn't vote on it at Polygon. Indiana Jones, I think the best way to put it, I wrote this, we've talked about this, the really interesting thing about Indiana Jones and the Great Circle is that it is a video game that is one of the best Indiana Jones movies. It is number two or number three of the Indiana Jones movies. Like, quality-wise. Indiana Jones, especially lately, has been bad. And Machine Games came out with Indiana Jones and the Great Circle, and it is outstanding. Like, it is, it was unexpected for a licensed IP movie video game to just pitch perfect nail all of the beats of an Indiana Jones movie. a franchise that is as old as I am, right? Like early 80s.
Yeah, I think it's 81. Keep going.
But yeah, it's just, it's got all of the great puzzle solving, the collecting, the like globe trotting action, and the costume changes and Nazi punching that you could want from an Indiana Jones game, and just nails it.
Yeah, this is not the last time we'll talk about this game, spoilers. But it nails what it's going for, and it most importantly, it makes punching Nazis feel real good, mm-hmm. which is like the main Indiana Jones is made job. And when you tell me like I'm going to embody Indiana Jones, the first thing I want to know is how it feels to punch a fascista, mm-hmm. which you do a lot of doing in this game, and like it clears that bar. But which is satisfying from two levels, which is that Indiana Jones is not someone who's known for using a lot of guns. I mean, famously, he does for comedic effect in the first movie, and with the legend having it that Harrison Ford was sick and didn't want to do any more takes of the fight scene or didn't want to learn it, and suggested he just shoot the guy instead, and it's incredible and iconic. But most of the time, Indy gets into scuffles, it's fisticuffs, and so they nail that feel. Like the combo system is great. It feels so good to punch people. And also, like, yep. It's so much more viscerally satisfying to walk up to an Italian fascist at the in between the world wars and just punching him in the face while you watch the Pope meet with Mussolini. Like, it came out at the perfect time in December of last year. And it was, I wanted it to be cathartic, and it was. So, always cathartic to punch a Nazi, especially, unfortunately, cathartic to punch a Nazi right now. So, Fair. Yeah, it's such a delightful, delightful, delightful action game. Again, it'll come up again.
Yep.
But our, like, win or something, like, I think a rare game that I think everyone on staff played a lot of this year. And, like, for those of us who played it in early access years past as well, which Alice and I were both really heavy into the early access aspect of it, is, of course, Hades 2. Hard category to beat Hades in.
Absolutely.
Yes, Hades 1 was obviously, like, a really celebrated game. I don't think Hades 2 quite reaches the same heights. But the core action, the cycle of, pick a path, go down to this biome, face a boss, and repeat until you reach the final boss, which you will not do immediately. You will die again and again and again on your journey. And each death reveals a little more narrative, it makes you a little bit stronger. That formula still works, and it is fantastic. Hades 2 is a blast to play. Melanoi's moveset is obviously different. She's witchier than her brother. And so instead of, she does have an axe. She does have some, the knife. Some ability to get up personal. But she also has a lot of really fun ranged options that I just thought were a real blast to play with. I mean, the bosses are still very well designed. Manoi's skill set and power scaling is really fun to slowly unlock over runs. You get those satisfying moments of like, this is the best build I have ever been able to put together from various Olympian boons and upgrades I found. And then, you beat a boss and you're like, oh, I'll never top that. And then you've gotten a lot better at the game. So you do start to top yourself. And it's a lovely cycle, Narratively, I don't think it pulled that trick off as well as it did the first time. But with action like this, I still just had a blast playing this for just hours at a time.
Yeah, it's the perfect game for the action category, because I mean, for my money, I prefer almost every single weapon in Hades 2 over their Hades 1 equivalent. So that's not something I think I ever would have expected to be saying years after Hades 1 came out. I think at this point I am on team. I would love to see what Supergiant does next. That's not Hades. But also I am of the opinion that they could probably release a Hades game every other year in perpetuity, and it would probably end up on my top 10 list every year. Supergiant just knows what they're doing with this series, and just in general, like, they're one of the best indies working at the moment. And I know it's a rare studio that I feel like lucky to be able to play their games when they come out. They do it so good.
Hades 2 is, it's both obvious. It's a little bit safe for the winner of this category, but when you take an already great premise like Hades 1 and hone it even more and perfect it a little bit, it's just, it's the only choice. Like, it's so good. And, I did not beat it yet, but, like, I am happy to go back to that game because I was not tired of it or burned out on it or sick of any of the mechanics. It just, like, it's a really great game.
Nope, they nail it, and you got to give it to them when they nail it. So, Hades 2, our best
action game. Shout out to Scylla and the Sirens for just the moment when the music video, you know, comes up. What a lovely, what a lovely gig. What a great little joke. It lasts for about 30 seconds, and a game I put like 100 hours into. But it gave me a chuckle.
That is an infuriating boss fight. I hate that.
She's
got to
focus on the drummer
first.
She's got to take the drummer out first, and then you're all good.
Yeah.
Just burn that drummer down, and then he ain't got no problems anymore. All right, that's gonna do it for our first part of this show. As you're watching, we're gonna have more mainstay games or more mainstay categories coming out as you're listening to this. We already put out Best Story and Best Indie, the nominees for that earlier in the week. And then on Friday of when you're listening to this, the day after Christmas, we have the Best AAA Game poll coming up. The polls are all going to be out for these, so be sure to go and vote if you want to get to contribute to the community awards that came out. It's already too late by the time you're listening to this for our first five. You can still do the others. And then on the 29th, we start with the Most Innovative. And then Game of the Year nominees come out on the 30th before revealing the winners on January the 2nd, which is where you can also find us for our second part of this podcast, where we're going to go over, all those other categories. But as of now, this has been our first part, our bonus episode of Rogue Signal. Please go check out our winners and our nominees. They're all great. If you're looking for something to play over the holidays. All of these things obviously come with big recommendations from us. Otherwise, we wouldn't be awarding them anything. As always, thank you so much for listening and for following us here at Rogue. If you're interested in supporting us, you can get all of our articles, everything that we put behind the paywall for just $7 a month or $70 a year. That knocks out the paywall entirely. We do some other stuff for the higher tiers, and we'll be doing some changes to that in the new year, and we'll have even more stuff that you can access for that $7 a month subscription. But any support you can give us is great. We're completely ad-free. We're completely human-based, which is something that we have to say in 2025 and going into 2026, which sucks, but, you know, we're happy to be people that guarantee that's how we're always going to operate. But even just signing up for a free account helps us. We know it's a hard time out there, but believe us, we get it. But if you sign up for a newsletter and make a free account, you can see a bunch of other stuff that we put behind our members' wall as well. So Rogue wouldn't exist without your support and without your listening and your care and sharing us on social media. It's all super helpful and we appreciate it. We hope you have a great holiday if you're celebrating, and just a great week if you're not. And we'll see you next week for part two of our awards and the Platinum Trophy for Game of the Year. I've been Ryan Gilliam with Jeff Tarkin and Cass Marshall.
Happy holidays.